This is the second in the series Faith's Challenge. The subject today is, does faith make sense? I wonder if it makes sense to ask you whether you can read this from back there.
No.
You can't.
I'm glad in my clothes.
Okay. The people up close can't read it either, I understand, but I got a C- in penmanship. This is my outline today, and I'll talk about that. And I won't assume that you can necessarily read. I thought it was pretty easy to see, but okay. Well, the main thrust today is on the fact that the Christian faith claims to represent a body of knowledge, that the claims of the faith are true, that there are assertions, sentences about reality which correspond to something outside themselves. When I say there is a God who has acted in history to redeem God's people, I am making a claim about something which allegedly is the case. I wanted to read a statement from Harold Pinter's play, The Homecoming, where a character says this: "How can the unknown merit reverence? In other words, how can you revere that of which you're ignorant? At the same time, it would be ridiculous to propose that what we know merits reverence. What we know merits any one of a number of things, but it stands to reason that reverence isn't one of them. In other words, apart from the known and the unknown, what else is there?" I think Harold Pinter is right that there isn't a third available here. If we claim we're reverencing something, then we have to say, do we believe we know what we're talking about? Is this a knowledge claim, or are we talking about the unknown? And if we're talking about the unknown, Pinter's assertion is, on what basis would you reverence, would you adoration to that which you don't know? Well, I think the Christian faith comes down solidly on the side of that there is something in the known which is worthy of reverence. It disagrees with Pinter when Pinter says, what we know merits any number of things, but one of them certainly isn't reverence. It disagrees with that. It says there is that which we know that is worthy of reverence. Now, that's what needs to be defended. The way I have thought to proceed is to identify a number of questions. Maybe I should stand. I don't know if that would be helpful. But a number of questions that are put to the Christian faith, and then try to consider what responses are possible to those questions. In making those responses, I do not want to assume Christian revelation. There's a sense in which the dialogue begins on the ground of the person who is not a Christian. It does not assume that you have to accept the Christian revelation. I can come to you on your ground. You can come to me on my ground. And we can dialogue together. At some point, of course, the Christian speaks out of his or her own store, his or her own treasure of faith. One cannot conduct a conversation totally on the ground of the other person. But one begins there, one stays there, one works with that, one never totally abandons it. I'm arguing for a connection. I've used the words, you know, question and quest. And it's human to question God. It's human to quest for God. And question and quest have an awful lot together in common. It isn't the case that the Christian possesses God and the non-Christian is simply, you know, way out of it. They are together, questioning and questing. So I think there's a large basis for this kind of common ground. So in trying to respond to some of these questions, I want to have two things in mind. One is, does the charge or question, does it misrepresent the faith, in which case it needs correcting? There are people who are not Christians who are busy rejecting the ridiculous ideas of a fourth grade Sunday school teacher or something like that. And the Christian faith is forever capsulized in that notion. And if you tried to correct them, they'd say, no, I know what the Christian... Jean-Paul Sartre, I don't know whom he had for fourth grade Sunday school, but Sartre, for example, knows exactly who God is, only there isn't one. And if you try to suggest a different image of God, which is one of my suggestions today during this week, is to try to sketch a different conception of God. If you try to do that, Sartre says, no fair, I know who God is, and there isn't one. For Sartre, God is the synthesis of the in itself and the for itself, and there ain't none. Well, that's not our subject today, what Sartre thinks of God, but what we Christians do. If there's something that needs correcting, if the charge is misrepresenting the faith, then we have an obligation to state the correction. Secondly, then, we are concerned, I am concerned, to try to work within the ground of common reality. We live together in the world. We all have to face death. Kubler-Ross is of interest to Christians and to non-Christians. We all have to get through the day. We all have to relate to our families. We all have experiences of humor, puzzlement, order, mystery. I'm not going to say at this point that we all have experiences of God, although my personal belief is that there is no person in the universe who does not experience God, though that person may not know the name. And sometimes the Christian's role is to name for that person, help that person name what he or she is experiencing. Well, that's just by way of a preliminary way this is going. Now, in 7 and 8 down here, can we find a living God through experience? And can a self but truly limited God make sense? Those last two questions. These are more the constructive direction where I'm trying to go. I'm trying to argue for a living but limited God, a limited but living God, known through experience. In a sense, the fuller answer to these six questions, there are a number of places where I can't really respond to them. I think the word answer, I used it, is not a fortunate term. I don't want to say answer the questions, but respond. The fuller response really at some point requires 7 and 8, but I want to start up here. One question that is put to us, if we say that the Christian faith is a claim for knowledge, that we really know something, is the question, is the knowing experiential? In our time, most people would say that a knowledge claim has to be backed by some kind of experience. What's the basis for your claim? What is your experience? I can accept someone else's experience, I don't have to experience it personally, so long as I have grounds for believing that that person knows whereof he or she speaks. That he has some experience, she has some experience, which is a responsible basis for that claim. Is the Christian faith based on experience? Is our Christian experience such? Wouldn't you say you have that? And there are a couple of ways this takes shape. One way the question is put to us is the Christian faith so rooted in the past? Is it so directed to the first century? Let's just take the first century. Is it buried in the sands of the first century? Now, there's some sense in which nobody is experiencing the first century. Some of us aren't past the 19th yet, but nobody's back in the first century. I mean, we are 20th century people. So if the God of whom we speak is sort of locked up in the first century, it's not an empirical claim. It's not based on experience. What I would want to say about that, what I'm trying to do is make sort of a preliminary response. And I'll go a little ways here and then pause. But if you have something you want to come in with as we go along, I would be glad to have you do that. These questions are ones I know you've thought about, and I'm sure there are many people here to make contributions. What I would want to say then is what's crucial for us is to try to find a way to talk about our own experience of God. That we're not simply dependent on the word from outside of us. I'd like to try to distinguish between two notions, the authoritative and the authoritarian. The Christian faith depends upon an authoritative relationship, but not an authoritarian one. What's the difference? Well, there's a nice little book by a man named Donald Evans, which is called The Language of Self-Involvement, and he gives us a little parable about a king and two, not servants, but two people who don't know the king, two natives who are in the king's country but don't know the king. Anyway, the king is riding in his pomp and circumstance, and the natives see the king, and they do not know what they're supposed to do. They do not cower before the king. They do not bow down. And the king cries out at them and says, "I command you to kneel." Well, the natives don't even understand the language. So there's no communication going on here. But of course, they're bright enough to recognize that this is a dangerous fellow up there on the throne. He's waving this thing around. They get down low. It looks like they have obeyed the king. They have not obeyed the king. They haven't understood the king. This is an authoritarian relationship, not an authoritative one. What's the difference? The authoritative depends upon understanding, upon communication, upon a genuine response from the one who is under authority. We are not our own authorities, but we are involved in a relationship. Authority is a relationship. The authoritative depends upon that relationship. We have a basis in our experience. Why do you believe the pastor? What makes you think the pastor's right? Well, because he went to the seminary. What makes you think the seminary's right? Well, because the seminary works with the Bible. What makes you think the Bible's right? What's your basis? It's alive for you. It rings true. It makes sense. It connects with your experience. I'm not talking about proof here, but I'm talking about some kind of connection, fit with your experience. I think that at some point, if there is no empirical base at all, then we're talking about an authoritarian relationship. We're talking about a relationship which really takes you out of yourself in a negative sense. I don't think this collapses our Christian faith simply into the self. We much need the experience of others. It is not our experience, but it must connect with our own experience. God is alive in our world and working and can be known. Well, I think I may have taken too long on that point, but it seemed to me to be rather fundamental to much of what follows. And I want to talk about that down under 7. Can we find a living God through experience? I certainly believe so. In a sense, that's the theme of the rest of the week. The other thing I just wanted to say was that there's a sense in which if there is knowing that's based on experience, there's a sense in which such knowing is tentative or subject to revision. David's question yesterday when you asked about, well, how do you dialogue with someone without, in a sense, exposing yourself to the possibility of really radical change on your part? I think that's, as I said yesterday, I think that's correct. And one of the charges put against the Christian is that she is not open to evidence. Eunice really raised that in a way, too, yesterday. I have a quote here from a man named Richard Robinson that puts it rather well. Just read this for you. "It seems to me that religion buys its benefits at too high a price, namely the price of abandoning the ideal of truth and shackling and perverting human reason. The religious person refuses to be guided by reason and evidence. The person does not say, 'I believe there is a God, but I'm willing to listen to argument that I am mistaken, and I shall be glad to learn better.' He does not seek to find and adopt the more probable of the two contradictories, there is a God or there is no God. On the contrary," I'm not good at inclusivizing this without practicing, "he or she makes his or her choice between those two propositions once for all. This person is determined never to revise the choice, but to believe that there is a God no matter what happens." So that issue will be before us. Is Christian faith open to evidence against it? My hope is that we are as Christians, that we're not simply blindly holding to this, that if somebody could really bring forward, now you'd say, well, what is it? Show me what it would be. And I have some things to talk about there. That we would at least pay attention to that. Otherwise, it seems to me we're in an essentially authoritarian relationship. Now, a second question that follows very naturally from that is the question, does that which is known, if we distinguish between the process of knowing, is it an empirical process, and then that which we claim to know, the content, does the known connect with our world? That is, by using the notion of world, I'm suggesting some sort of unity. If you came in today and told me, did you realize that the mountain collapsed? while you were speaking. And I said, no, and I went out and I said, oh, it's still there, you see. And he said, well, it's back up again. Now, I have no basis. I suppose that may have happened, but it doesn't connect with my world. There's a regularity, there's a reliability, there are things you can count on in the world. There is a world, there's a gathered experience. There's a connectedness in our experience of reality. Does the faith connect with that? Or does it stand out over in a corner by itself so that it not only maybe doesn't connect, but maybe it violates, maybe it contradicts that other shape of reality? Now, of course, one response that's available, I want you to realize that I am aware of it as I reject it, but one response that is available is to say, well, you finally caught on. Of course it doesn't connect with our reality because it's wholly other. You just have to pronounce the Latin phrase totaliter aliter. You just have to learn some new lingo and then you'll realize what faith is. It's not supposed to connect. You finally caught on, good for you. I think that again, is really selling out. How is a person to understand his or her humanity in that case? Surely, God, the God of creation, the God of that person's humanity, is the same God of redemption. You know, every person alive is a creature of God. That doesn't mean we're not sinners. The Lutherans fought this out in the Reformation period when Matthias Flacius, probably haven't read Flacius just lately, but Matthias Flacius suggested that sin had become human substance so that we were no longer the creatures of God. We were the creatures of the devil. Does anyone remember confessing we are by nature sinful and unclean? We are by nature creatures not of God, Flacius said. Well, not but of the devil. Fortunately, the reformers called that, spotted it, and said, no, that's a heresy. We are through and through sinful, but we're still God's creatures. We belong to God, not to the devil. There is some health in us, though there is also sickness in us. There's a lot of big issues on how to sort that out, of course. So I think if somebody says that the fact that it makes no connection with the created human being is a sign of its truth, I think that's really abandoning the doctrine of creation. And I would not see any basis. You're really offering only a redemptive God who's redeeming something. Why would God want to redeem that anyway? It's not, that doesn't belong to God, apparently. Well, so does it connect? Now, this, of course, involves the whole issue of the problem of evil. If you've looked at that rather confusing goldenrod sheet that I handed out yesterday, you know that the fuller discussion of the problem of evil is up for tomorrow. But I want to read one passage that sort of raises this for us. It's a famous passage by Antony Flew. Some of you know this, I think. I will deal a little with it today, but I hope much more tomorrow. Once upon a time, two explorers came upon a clearing in a jungle. In the clearing were growing many flowers and many weeds. One explorer says, some gardener must tend this plot. The other explorer disagrees. There is no gardener. So they pitch their tents and they set a watch. No gardener is ever seen. But perhaps there is an invisible gardener. So they set up a barbed wire fence. They electrify it. They patrol the blood mountains. For they remember how H.G. Wells, the invisible man, could be both smelt and touched, though he could not be seen. But no shriek ever suggests that some intruder has received a shock. No movements of the wire ever betray an invisible climber. The bloodhounds never give cry, yet still the believer is not convinced. But there is a gardener, invisible, intangible, insensible to electric shocks. A gardener who has no scent and makes no sound. A gardener who comes secretly to look after the garden which he loves. At last, the skeptic despairs. But what remains of your original assertion? How does what you call an invisible, intangible, eternally elusive gardener differ from an imaginary gardener? Or indeed, from no gardener at all? Now, somebody might object and say, this is not a religious proposition. The Christian is not saying, I think the Christian is saying that there's a gardener who tends this world. But it maybe isn't the bedrock of religion. So maybe you'd like a proposition that's a little warmer and juicier, and Flew gives us one. fortunately, accommodates. Take this One more paragraph. Someone tells us that God loves us as a father, mother, as a father loves his children. We are reassured. But then we see a child dying of inoperable cancer of the throat. His earthly father is driven frantic in his concern to help. But his heavenly father reveals no obvious signs of concern. Some qualification is made. God's love is not a merely human love, or it is an inscrutable love, perhaps, and we realize that such sufferings are quite compatible with the truth of the assertion that God loves us as a father, but of course, we are reassured again. But then perhaps we ask, just what is this assurance of God's appropriately qualified love really worth? Just what is this apparent guarantee really a guarantee against? Just what would have to happen, not only morally and wrongly to tempt, but also logically and rightly to entitle us to say God does not love us, or even that God does not exist? Well, that's the problem of evil. Given the suffering in the world, what makes you think God loves you? That's the question the skeptic puts to us. Or that there's a God. This is kind of a trade-off. I mean, we might be able to rescue a God who doesn't love us, but then religion becomes a religion of obeisance and fear. It becomes perverted in its nature. I don't think we can simply dismiss this question. There's one move, for example. I'll just mention a move that was often made, and it goes like this, saying, well, of course, the Christian faith doesn't offer evidence because it's a faith about the future. All things will be made sound in the future. All things will be made whole and well in the future. And now we suffer. The sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing to the glories that will be revealed to us. We're home free. I don't think it works. It doesn't work for me, because what's to make you confident that is not just a... If you came to me after this lecture and said, you know, I haven't understood a word you've said in these first two lectures, and I noticed there are other opportunities around here, I'm considering going to those. And if I were to say to you, well, by Friday in the 55th minute of my lecture, all things will be clear. You wouldn't go for it. I expect a smaller crowd regularly, but you wouldn't take that kind of eschatological verification. You want something. You don't have to. I take it you don't have to have everything now. You can work with some ambiguity, but you want some clarity. If I'm doing a foot dance around you, you're not going to stand for that. So, similarly, I think God offers a first fruits, a taste, a rabban. There's a relation. Are you in relationship with God or aren't you? Is this God suddenly going to become good when you die? No, this God is a good God now who aims to bless you. So what is it worth? What does it count for? That's the question these people are putting to us. I think it's a fair question. We cannot simply dismiss it. Again, I want to talk about that down here. Just a couple more things, then it's important to stop and get a little... You're being very patient here. I think the next two can go more quickly. Do we know enough to act? Maybe some people who are not Christians would say, well, there's some things, all right. There are some things we haven't figured out. There's a man named Ronald Hepburn, for example, who has written a critique of Christianity. And then he writes an epilogue, funny epilogue, where he says, you know, I just can't figure out this religion business. There's something going on there. And it was really interesting. After he's written a sustained 200-page critique, and then he says, but I am puzzled by it all. There's a sense in which there are non-Christians who would grant that there's something going on here. You can't just dismiss it. But do we know enough to act? And these people often would say, we don't know enough to act. We don't know enough to step forward and say, count me in. I want to be in this community. I want to stand with this. I want to give my life for it. Now, the question that we're kind of facing here is, are we to proceed by a rhetoric of dissent and suspicion? Or are we to proceed by a rhetoric of assent? When somebody makes a proposition to you, what's your initial reaction? That's an interesting question, quite apart from God. Do you say, well, show me something, I'd like to see what you got over there. Is there some sense in which to be a human is to be created in relationship and to be more vulnerable, more able to open yourself to the other? Now, does this mean wishful thinking? Anything goes. Great, the mountain is down, it's coming back up, there it goes. I'm not trying to say a rhetoric of ascent works that way, but if you're in a living relationship with the reality of God working in time, maybe a rhetoric of ascent makes more sense than a rhetoric of dissent or suspicion. I want to read a quote from William James. James believed, as I believe, that things aren't true, that we're not done yet. And this is what he said about it. You know, if everything was done, you'd hold a higher standard. I wrote down here, how much is enough? Do we know enough to act? Well, how much is enough? If somebody says to you, I love you, what counts as evidence? How much evidence is enough, and what counts as evidence? Those questions you have to engage. Now, if somebody says to you, this wood is composed of the following chemicals, a different standard of evidence presumably applies. I don't think the wood is significantly alive. But this human being who says she loves you is alive. Much more interesting to have a living lover than a dead one. How do you respond to a living lover? You know, this is what William James says. This is a nice passage. When I look at the religious question as it really puts itself to concrete people, and when I think of all the possibilities which both practically and theoretically it involves, then this command that we shall put a stopper on our heart, instincts and courage, and wait, acting meanwhile, of course, more or less as if religion were not true, this command, I say, seems to me to be the queerest idol ever manufactured in the philosophic cave. Nice statement, I think. Were we scholastic absolutists, there might be more excuse. If we had an infallible intellect with an objective certitude, then we might feel ourselves disloyal to such a perfect organ of knowledge and not trusting to it exclusively and not waiting for its releasing bell. But if we are empiricists, if we believe in experience, if we are empiricists, if we believe that no bell in us tolls to let us know for certain when truth is in our grasp, then it seems a piece of idle fantasticality to preach so solemnly our duty of waiting for the bell. You know, how do you know when somebody loves you? Do you hear a bell? Well, then don't wait for the bell if you don't hear a bell. If God and we are together in the universe, if things aren't finished, if God is calling us into a relationship, then to ask for the evidence that would be forthcoming only in the relationship, only in living the relationship, is really a stupid thing to do. You have to, there's some place, I'm not going to say blind faith, but there's something venturing. I believe, help thou my unbelief. I'm trying, God. I want to be with you, God. That makes much more sense than to say, well, let's see what you've got, God. I've got a full house, what have you got? That's not the way to play this game with God. I think there are some responses. Fourthly, is the object simply, is that which we're relating to allegedly, is that which we claim to know simply self and world? A quick thing here. I want to just mention the names of Ludwig Feuerbach and Sigmund Freud. You know, I will not dispatch them in 3 minutes. They'll last longer than I will. And I know that. But I think there's something to be said about this. The critique of both Feuerbach in the 19th century and Freud in the early 20th century are very similar, namely that religion is probably an illusion. Freud distinguishes between a delusion and an illusion. A delusion is something that we can establish as false, and we cling to that falsehood anyway. An illusion is something we don't really know it's false, but wish fulfillment is a prominent element in the motivation. It feels so great. Isn't it feel great to know that there's a God that takes care of you? It's so lonely since you left your mother's womb. Now you've got this great God who will get you through. You can go to sleep on your pillow. Everything is fine. You can't. And of course, the call there is to grow up, stand on your feet, be an adult. You're alone in the world. Make up what you can. Be courageous. don't commit the apostasy. That's what Freud is saying. He doesn't know that religion is a hoax, but it sure looks like an illusion, because there's a prominent element of wish fulfillment. Feuerbach, on the other hand, notes how the curve of religion always returns to the human. Even the human who abases himself or herself still ends up being blessed by God. So there's a circular character. Religion is really self-interest. It's self-love. It's the human returning to itself. It's a much more complete discussion. But now, what do you say about that? This is real tricky stuff, I think. One possibility would be to say that Feuerbach and Freud are wrong because religion is not self-fulfillment. Well, when I go to church, I really feel bad, and therefore Feuerbach and Freud would be wrong. But then why keep going to church if that's the case? You know, I don't think we can make that move. It's called masochism, actually. I mean, if you're in religion because you feel so bad, I think that needs to be looked at. So if we don't say that, if we do say that the Christian faith is a faith of gospel, good news. I've got something really good for you. I know we put it in terrible ways sometimes. You know, we say on the television Sunday night, we say, God is going to bless you real good or something. But it's right. God is going to bless you real good. That's the message. Now, does that play right into the hands of Feuerbach and Freud then? Well, I would just say this, two little responses. And this is a kind of a matter of correcting the charge in terms of the content. There are at least many Christians. There are at least some Christians. There are at least a couple Christians. 50, 40, 30. Will you destroy the world if there are 10 Christians? Anyway, who have broken the circle of self-interest. Now, I think if you ask Mother Teresa, is she getting self-fulfillment? I think she wouldn't understand the question. But I think if you could explain the question to her, she'd say, I'm having the greatest time in the world in my life. This is terrific. But she's certainly broken the circle of narrow self-interest. Her life is out there in those other people. And of course, she's not feeling bad about it. But it's not a simple kind of self-interest. You get outside yourself, and then you find yourself in that process. Or Martin Luther King, you can bring your own examples. I think it is a problem, though. I can't answer these things. I'm trying to respond to them. I think it is a problem that so many people do not break the circle of self-interest. They just stay right tight within that circle, and that does raise the question of whether religion is not functioning in the way Freud and Feuerbach say. Second thing I want to say, probably should have been first, but
well, we need to turn the tape over.
No, it turns itself over,
it
actually. Yeah, it's these are new things, you know.
Thank you.
Yeah, all I had to do was to get this button up to this level, and it's going well. Second thing I want to say was, I think we have to be careful of psychological intimidation by these critics. What I mean by that is, if the word of the gospel is good news, there seems to be an implicit suggestion that it therefore must be false. The only kind of news that could be true would be bad news. You know. Well, why is that the case? I mean, there might be good news. It doesn't prove there's good news, but what I call psychological intimidation is sort of the assumption that if something good is said to you, you've probably made it up. No, if somebody says to you, I love you, that person might love you. Maybe you can't understand it, but that's still possible that person doesn't talk about you. So, I'm going to take a break here. Let's get some other conversation going. These other things will come along, but do you have some response or reaction? We're sort of halfway, a little more than halfway, actually, in terms of time.
I have a question about what you mean by the word connect. To me, it has a number of meanings, and I'm not sure which one, what you mean. Does it mean it's consistent with my other perception of the world? Does it mean that it adds to clarity of my situation? Does it mean that this other influences my behavior? What do you mean by
that? Excellent. I mean several things. And that, you know, I think there are different forms of connection. Places that which is otherwise known apart from faith in a broader context, for example, grounds it, roots it. If, for example, let me give you an example. If I believe that I am a psychosomatic unity, that my body and mind and whatever else there might be in me is all interconnected, if I know that by some of my medical studies, I don't know it absolutely, but it seems likely. Then if the Christian faith comes along and says, actually what you are is a soul stuck in a body, and fortunately the body is simply a temporary house, and your real identity and the thing you have to care about, well, if that's what the Christian faith says, that doesn't connect. Now, it doesn't mean that my psychosomatic unity cannot be lifted to a new level. I can have a body and my body can be transformed. I don't mean that the Christian faith leaves our view of reality quite as it is. It can alter it, it can comprehend it, lift it up to a new level, it can put it in an intensified form. I want to talk tomorrow about how the experience of the moral and the experience of the beautiful are completed within the experience of the godly. So that moral experience, which is genuine intensification, and aesthetic experience, which is genuine intensification, is elevated to a new level in genuine religion. But it's not, there's some kind of fabric and structure in our knowledge of reality which cannot be distorted. So I would say it can be grounded, it can be broadened, it can be lifted to a new level of intensification, but there must be a connection. What I'm against is schizophrenia. Where you're trying to live your or where religion actually takes over. I think this might be the difference between the cultic and the sacral, the genuine and religious. Tillich distinguishes between demonic ecstasy and divine ecstasy. In demonic ecstasy, the self is destroyed. That's the cultic experience. And I think I agree, actually. I've talked with some personal relatives here who have been involved in this, and they come out, I can't recognize them anymore. They don't laugh the same way. They don't hook the ball in golf anymore. They're changed. Their humanity has been killed. Divine ecstasy, you extol. You do stand outside yourself. There's something, you're not just the same. Religion is not just a new name. There is a transforming power. But I like Thomas Aquinas, that great Lutheran theologian, who said, grace does not destroy, but perfects nature. Now, it does destroy sin, but not nature. So it's an excellent question. It points to the imprecision of what I've done so far. There are many ways to talk about that connection. But there are some things that aren't connections. Not everything works as connection.
I'm not following a lot of what you're saying. Kind of above my level in many ways, but I plugged into something there, and I remember a long time ago having a conversation with my sister who was all excited about some book that she had found that talked about all the levels of angels and this whole angelic universe and where it all made sense, and she was trying to convince me that this was all true in some objective way, and that I should accept that as being true, and I said, well, I believe that science has worked out the probability of my holding out an object and it not falling to the earth. There is presumably some minute probability or possibility that might in fact happen. But I can't live my life assuming that I can hold out a glass of water or a baby and that it will float in midair. It doesn't connect to my world. And I have to live my life based on what I can understand, that kind of continuity. And so this whole hierarchy of angels and a lot of the Christian religion, the supernatural aspect of it, fall into that category for me. They don't fit into anything that I understand about the world and how it works, and not only my experience, but my best knowledge of my experience of the world. And that's where I plug in what you're talking about there.
Yeah, no, you've understood a lot, in spite of what I've said. I would say, let me refer you to a beautiful book written in the middle of the 19th century by Horace Bushnell. The title of the book is really pretty. Nature and the Supernatural as Together Constituting One System of God. Now, In other words, there's only one God around. If you've got two gods, you don't have any. There's one God, and that God's around. And wherever we experience God, there is connection. So that when the medical doctor goes into surgery, that doctor is working with God's world and the principles. I don't think natural law is a absolute mechanistic kind of thing. Sittler has a nice discussion of this in the Gravity and Grace book that's on sale in the bookstore. Gravity is not, when I step off the ledge, the gravity is not saying, thou shalt fall, but the odds are I'm going to fall. It works with remarkable regularity. But in the causal weave of reality, there is some unpredictability. So that law is not an absolute mechanism. There is freedom within reality. There are inexplicable. I would like to use the word extraordinary rather than supernatural, because supernatural, despite Bushnell's title, immediately suggests sort of two worlds and you're kind of gluing them together. But within the realm of the ordinary, we know how things mostly work. But then there are surprising developments. And as I said yesterday, science is backing off from claiming that they've developed some kind of knowledge of an absolute law. I think they're backing off too far. I want them to stay in there and believe they're talking about very significant regularities. How do we understand spontaneous remission? How do we understand some of these phenomena? They do appear to happen. Nature is not an absolute law, but it is regular.
Can you understand that supernatural partly also in terms of intensification? Something
I think so.
Supernatural as something is super good or yeah. super beautiful.
Yeah.
This is
not extra natural. It's, yeah. Yes, if we kept the word super in that sense, but I think when people
you
usually
can't
use
it, yeah.
they think of Superman, you know, who flies through the air. And that's not intensification, doesn't seem.
Right. Isn't it part of the problem that I'm resonating with too is the question of what it is you're meaning by knowing here?
Yep.
Seems to be that the way you're playing with it mostly today is the dynamic between experience of faith, the experience of the world, and the experience of religion. But so much of the way we think about knowing these days has to do with science. It doesn't have to do really with experience or faith. It has to do with another level of stuff to which we claim obeisance as really the only valid level of knowledge.
And I think that's what needs to be challenged. I don't want to give it up. I want the knowing that I think faith is devoted to a knowing. It's a different kind of knowing, but word like level is one way to talk about it. I think that the degree of life, the degree of complexity, these are discernible differences. If I'm relating to a human being, this is much more complex than a set of molecules. The possible permutations are far greater, so that it's appropriate that the organ of knowledge, that the human response epistemologically would be different. That isn't special pleading. I don't ask the artist to explain his work by explaining the chemical constituents in the pigment, although that's pertinent. I think the idea I like very much the word comprehend. Comprehend means to take within and lift to a new level, but not violate what you're taking in. So I think that unfortunately the word know has been claimed by two schools. One is the radical empiricist. That's that chart I had on the board yesterday. David Hume over here and Descartes over there. Either knowing seems to me just what you can touch and taste and feel, or it means just what I kind of feel in my gut. And then I've given up the world. What we need to do is get the self and the world back together again. And that's God's role. God connects. Both the self and the world are God's. And that's where we know God. I want to talk about how we know God in relationship to the self. That's the moral. And I want to talk about how we know God in relationship to the world. That's the next day, which I think is probably Thursday. So we need the scientist. And we need to pay attention to what that person says, but we don't worship it. The nice little book here that I'm sure some of you have read is Wayne Booth's book, The Rhetoric of Assent, where he just really takes off on that simplistic empiricism. Something else right now? Well, I could do a couple more little things here, and then we'll have some more time yet. Now I'm sort of shifting. As Jody just pointed out, these previously were sort of concerned with experience. Now this is shifting sort of to kind of a more conceptual or logical set of issues, although there's still an experiential flavor to it. What I've written under five here is this God, a holy other, hence non-compossible. I think it's very important to have a word that nobody understands. So this word comes from Leibniz, a 17th century, late 16th, 17th century philosopher. This word has been reintroduced into the technical field now by Lane and Gilkey. Anyway, what it means is non-compossible. When you're at dinner tonight and you're with someone who wasn't at the session here, you can say, you know, I think Holden is non-compossible. Just casually drop it off. What it means is that the world of religion just doesn't, it's so weird. It's so other. Let me try to illustrate it now. What attributes, if you went over to the library here and you looked at the dogmatics books, I was there this afternoon and they're all safely in the stack. No one's checking off. But anyway, if you looked at them, they're the ones that I read and write, you know. But anyway, how is God described? God is immutable. God is eternal. God is invisible. God is timeless. All those negative attributes, you know, if I had a big board, I could put them down for you. You know what I'm talking about. Now, how recently have you bumped into something like that? You know, not since yesterday, I'm fairly sure. This doesn't connect. I mean, it's the same kind of issue in a way. It's non-compossible. It isn't that you have a specific objection. It isn't that you can sort of say, well, it's not quite right. No, it just doesn't connect. You, who are you? You are a temporal being. Do you ever know that? You got out of bed this morning, you felt older. You are a physical being. Nobody ever says, here I am and I brought my body with me. No. So if the Christian faith comes along and offers you this weird God, maybe under an authoritarian system you could knuckle under for a while. But fortunately, your humanity begins to assert itself. And at some point you just say, well, thanks a lot, but no thanks. You know, if you enjoy it, blessings on you, though I think you're sick. But so is the Christian faith, and I think for a lot of people today, it isn't that they have specific objections, but it's just non-compossible. It's just another world. Thanks, I'm living in this world. It's not a great world, but it's my world. That's an issue. I think that that's partly the fault of the theologians. We have created a God, an image of God. We don't create gods, actually. We have created an image of God that is not faithful to either religious experience or the biblical witness. We have created a God with all these negative attributes. I call this God the All Big Ten God. I suppose I should, what is it, the Big Eight out here? No, what is this conference? Pacific Coast or?
West Coast.
West Coast. Anyway. I can't keep track of these minor conferences, but the God who is the all-everything God. Now that God is non-compossible. What I'm trying to work with is a living God, a God who is alive, and the attributes that we poorly formulate, I think it, unfortunately, is largely the influence of Greek philosophy. For the Greeks, for Plato, the timeless was of more value than the timely, than the temporal. That which was immutable was of more value than that which was subject to change. And so on, going down the list. And the early Greek philosophers did affect Christian theology. Unfortunately, that's the case. But if you look at the God who was hanging on the cross, if you look at the God who was saying over Jerusalem, how often would I have gathered you as a hen gathers her chicks? I would, but you would not. You don't see the all Big Ten God. That's not that God. It's a different God. This God is alive. This God is suffering. This God is in jeopardy. or you look back in the Old Testament, the pictures of God that you have there. I will not execute my fierce anger against you. My compassion wells up within me. I will not come to destroy. I will come. This God is alive. This God is with us, working with us. I think we need to develop a concept of a living God who is not non-compossible with our reality. Does the knowledge of God collapse in contradiction? That's the sixth question. This is a more specific thing. Some of the things we say about God, once we get the subject going, and I guess I'm talking about theologians first, technical theologians. In some sense, I believe every Christian is a theologian, if she or he thinks at all about her or his faith. But maybe especially the technical theologians, I think there's a tendency sometimes to make statements about God that really are on the horns of a dilemma, and then we cover them by paradox. Paradox is the religious name for a contradiction. You know, if you are a theologian, you can believe six impossible things before breakfast. That's the goal, and some of us are good at it. Well, I could illustrate this briefly. For example, we say that God is the sole cause of everything that happens or acts in the universe. We say that God is the one who does everything. And then we turn around and criticize people for sinning. Shame on you. You're an awful sinner. Well, just a minute. Now, who was it that did the action? Or even on the theme of the action of God, we sometimes act as if God is the only cause, but then we also talk as if God is a specific cause. Let me illustrate this by reading a statement from contemporary theologian Don Cupid. Here's the paradox. We need a little interventionist God to give personal qualities to the universal God and to stop him from fading into emptiness and vacuity. Conversely, the law-like cosmic God is needed to give breadth and universality to the little interventionist God and stop him from declining into a fantasy guardian spirit. But the two deities, the big one and the little one, are quite different from each other. They presuppose different cultural backgrounds, different overall views of the cosmic order and how it is maintained, and different views of God's relationships to humankind. Neither view of God will do well on its own. They need each other, yet they don't go well together. Or take the person of Christ. I don't have another board, but if you put up here, we all want to say that Jesus is truly human and truly divine, and then put down the attributes that go together there. Well, God is one who knows all things. But Jesus says in Mark 13:32, of that hour knows no one, neither the Son either, but only the Father who is in heaven. And in Mark 2, Jesus, it says of Jesus, he increased in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man. He wasn't born 6 feet tall, and he wasn't born knowing the world. He had to have experience. Does God have to have experience? Traditionally, theology has said God knows everything intuitively. Now, does Jesus have two minds? Is there a split down his forehead so that part of him knows everything intuitively and part of him has to kind of, like we do? You can understand how people outside the church say, that looks like plenty of business in there. And then it's not quite adequate to say, it's a paradox. Now, I think you can use the word paradox. You know, I don't think you can, I don't think Christians can give up the word, but we have to be very careful how we use it. Kierkegaard, the great Danish theologian, philosopher, says this, a Christian believes against the understanding, but a Christian will use his or her understanding to believe against the understanding. That is, you have to engage, you can in a sense, I think the word against is maybe even a little stronger than I want to go, but Kierkegaard says, and his whole authorship is doing this, is engaging the understanding to move beyond the understanding. It isn't just saying, it's a paradox. It's, as Pascal says, it's one thing when the great philosopher who has struggled all his life says, it's a paradox. And it's another thing when the college freshman says, it's a paradox! quite different. You know. So I have not come to Holden Village to attack paradox, but to critique the sloppy, slovenly use of it. And so I think we need to work. Now, the direction I would want to go, and I have some time ahead of us here in the next days, to try to develop a concept of a God who in creation has chosen to limit God's self and has let power out of God's hand. And now really is limited, not is impotent, that's not what I'm saying, but is limited, is working. And so I would want to take the various attributes, presence, power, knowledge, and try to talk about what one might helpfully say about them. A God who is alive, but is a coherent God, and can make sense and does not come across as one collapsing in contradiction. I think I should take the next, or we should try for some further discussion, though. I've gone a little too long here. That's kind of a sketch ahead. If there'd been a lot of time today, I would have gone into it. But what do you have?
How about if you don't want to go with omniscience because of a limited God, how about prescience? If,
presence?
Knowing before.
If
God has relinquished some power, limited himself in some sense, then it seems to me you still have the problem of evil, which would be that God knew before he did this what the consequences would be, that there would be this much suffering. Not only that there would be suffering, but that there would be a great degree of suffering, which is another aspect of that. Why should there be as much as there is, not less? And then in what sense is God loving? Or in what sense did he know everything at some point before he decided to limit his power, if he could allow that to happen?
Now, I think there are only two possible responses besides punting on a question like that.
It's a paradox.
That's another way. But one of the two isn't paradox. The one would be to say, and I'm not able to say this, but people do say it, and I think it deserves listening to, I guess, but I don't think it's adequate, is that foreknowledge, though it's there, does still not deter God. God has envisioned what will come of all this. This is the best of all possible worlds. It's not the best of all actual worlds. But through this, God is bringing many to glory. Many meaning all. God will have us all through suffering. I'm trying to present a view I don't hold. That's a possible view to say.
Is that Leibniz?
Yeah, Leibniz was there. And he, of course, lived before the Holocaust. But people would still say it. And Levi Sell, this remarkable Jewish writer, when I heard him speak, the first question from the floor was, well, where's God involved in this? And the one thing he said, it troubled me, I'll have to admit, was, well, you can't say God wasn't doing it. Now, it's imprecise, of course, doing it. But he said the one thing you can't say is God was just suffering under it. Some of you may have studied Wiesel more fully. I've read some of his writings. It's really remarkable to me that somehow he does not want to just put God in there as a victim, but somehow as an actor. And that's kind of his first view that I suggest. The second view would be to say, and I would be more inclined to go to the second view, that God knows all the possibilities as possibilities, and all that's actual as actual, but that because God is in a living relationship, and if God knows, if I knew all that was actual, I would know an awful lot about the future. Because where does the future come from but from the present and the past? Much of our surprise in life is due to the fact that we are ignorant about the actual. But nonetheless, this would still be to say that there would be an element of the future which God does not know. God does not know the future is actual. But he knows all the possibilities, and God knows what God will do, depending on what we do. So there's not that. God is never caught in the position saying, my goodness, what am I going to do? It wouldn't be that. But there would be some... Otherwise, what happens to the give and take of the relationship? I mean, the grieving over Jerusalem, or grieving over the rejection by any person. In a living relationship, see, I think there are three key attributes to mention: power, presence, and knowledge. There are others, but I would say the clearest one is power. If we're in a real relationship, there has to be power sharing. If we're the other end, I put presence, and I would want to say that the doctrine of omnipresence is not compromised at all. I believe God is present in every moment in the universe. That doesn't require the all Big Ten God. But in between would come knowledge. And I think that could be budged the one way or the other. If you talk about knowledge and God knows the future is actual, now there are a number of ways to do that. Some people draw it this way and say that God is outside of time. Boethius does this, for example, and says that God is non-temporal. So though to us it looks like God knows the future ahead of time, they're all simultaneous to God. I don't think that's a solution. Because that means that God really isn't involved in our life. Does before and after, that's the non-compossible God again. Does before and after, I think that means something. God does things in time. So, but there are such moves that have been made to try to answer it. I think the knowledge thing is in the middle. You can work with it. Harold Dittmanson, for example, at Saint Olaf College. I don't know if people know Dittmanson. He's probably taught Holden. He argues that God knows the future is actual. And he does a very nice job of explaining that. I don't agree with it, but I mean, there are people who do that. And that's probably the traditional view. Thank you. Yeah.